From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The UN Security Council will hold urgent talks Thursday on the pro-government coalition assault on the Houthi rebel-controlled Red Sea Yemeni port city of Hodeidah, viewed as the largest battle in that three-year conflict. The deputy director of Yemen operations for the relief organization CARE, Jolien Veldwijk, is in Hodeidah and fears yet another unfolding humanitarian disaster.
The port of Hodeidah feeds two-thirds of Yemen. We have 29 million people in Yemen, of which 8 million are already at risk of famine. 8 million people, even before this morning, were already at risk of starvation. If the port is closed, even for a day, this means that these people will die.
Fighting appears to be centered around control of the airport. Four Emirati soldiers reportedly have been killed. A spokesman for the Saudi and United Arab Emirates-led coalition said the objectives are both the airport and seaport through which most relief aid flows. Ohio State University Middle East analyst Alam Payen said it appears that coalition forces want to avoid a costly street battle.
And I do not know that really they can avoid this mass casualties on both sides, because the Houthis are not going to give up easily.
UN envoy Martin Griffith said he remains in contact with both sides. Hodeidah is located about 150 kilometers southwest of the capital, Sana'a, which is in rebel hands for the past 4 years. The awarding of the 2026 World Cup to North America Wednesday was met with bitter disappointment in Morocco after its fifth bid to host the football competition fell short again. The joint sponsorship of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. received 134 votes to Morocco's 65. 11 African nations voted for North America. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump, back from Tuesday's historic summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore Wednesday, said the world is safer as a result. He tweeted, "There is no longer a nuclear threat from the North." On Fox News, Mr. Trump was asked by reporter Brett Baer if he contemplates a drawdown of U.S. forces in South Korea.
"No, it's not drawing down at all. In fact, honestly, it was never discussed. I'm sure he'd like that. It was never on the table. When I met him today, we have a very good relationship, I feel. I feel it's good. You know, we know when we have chemistry. You know it as well as anybody, and you understand what I mean. We have 32,000 soldiers in South Korea. I'd like to get them home. I would like to, but it is not on the table right now."
South Korea's Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa Thursday said Singapore was the start of a process.
"We shared our understanding that the June 12th summit is not the end, but a new beginning towards a denuclearized and peaceful Korean peninsula."
Kong and her Japanese counterpart Taro Kono expressed concern over President Trump's decision to halt joint U.S. military exercises during the disarmament process.
"We understand that any pause in exercise is contingent upon DPRK action towards denuclearization."
Both diplomats held talks in Seoul with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who underscored the urgency of the North's disarmament, a process he hopes to achieve within the next 2.5 years. The UN General Assembly has condemned Israel for excessive use of force against Palestinian civilians and asked the UN Secretary General for a protection mechanism for occupied Palestinian territory.
"The result of the vote is as follows. In favor, 120. Against, 8. Abstentions, 45. Draft resolution A/ES-10/L23 is adopted."
The U.S. vetoed a similar resolution in the Security Council. Dozens of Palestinians were killed in recent protests along the Gaza-Israel frontier. At least 13 died when a passenger boat celebrating Eid capsized off the Indonesian island of Sulawesi Wednesday, 24 rescued, but many are still listed as missing. Canada's Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland met with U.S. lawmakers Wednesday in the wake of trade tensions following imposition of U.S. tariffs over steel and aluminum.
"The notion that Canadian steel and aluminum could pose a national security threat to the United States, I think Americans understand it's simply not the case."
Canada's also poised to introduce counter tariffs July 1st. On Mars, a dust storm threatens one of the U.S. Space Agency's NASA's rovers. Opportunity, landed in 2004, has now become dormant and unresponsive. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, June the 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. According to the World Health Organization, sub-Saharan Africa continues to carry a disproportionately high share of the global malaria burden, even though the governments spend millions of dollars in malaria control and elimination efforts, and that's mostly in malaria-endemic countries. But a new report says that the most widely used anti-malarial drug may not be that effective when it comes to treating children and pregnant women. And the Norwegian Refugee Council has released its list of the world's most neglected displacement crises, with the Democratic Republic of Congo topping their list.
It's mainly in Africa where the neglected crises are. Congo is with its high number of displaced in a very severe situation, of course.
Ulrika Blom is the country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And doctors in Kenya have filed a petition to block their government's plan to deploy 100 Cuban doctors.
We are submitting that the decision to pay the Cuban doctors a higher or a better remuneration package than the local one is discrimination, that they all ought to be paid a similar remuneration, they all ought to belong to the same job group.
Kenyan lawyer Anangwe Maloba, representing Kenyan doctors, the doctors say that they feel discriminated against in terms of employment. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan doctors are seeking to block their government's plan to deploy 100 Cuban doctors to fill gaps in the country's health care system. A group of unemployed doctors filed a lawsuit against the move, arguing that as citizens, they should have been hired first. But the Kenyan government has defied a court order blocking it from hiring the Cubans. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Despite opposition from Kenyan doctors and sections of the public, Kenyan health officials are going forward with a plan to use Cuban doctors in the country's public health care facilities starting next month. In doing so, the government also is defying a court order suspending the employment of some 100 doctors who arrived in the country last week. A petition was filed by four Kenyan doctors. Their lawyer, Anangwe Maloba, says the doctors feel discriminated against in terms of employment and pay.
We are submitting that the decision to pay the Cuban doctors a higher or a better remuneration package than the local ones is discrimination, that they all ought to be paid a similar remuneration, they all ought to belong to the same job group. The second point was that for the unemployed doctors, specialists, is that there are almost 171 specialist doctors who have not been able to secure employment to public health facilities.
Kenyan media reports say the Cuban doctors will be paid at least $8,000 each month. The doctors will also get free housing, transport and airfare. Rashid Aman is the chief administrative secretary at the Ministry of Health, and he says the Cuban doctors are needed in county hospitals.
Last 3 years, 156 medical specialists completed their studies at the University of Nairobi and Moi University, which are our two largest teaching hospitals, and were posted out to the counties. This number could not bridge the gap in health needs in Kenya.
But Edgar Washika, a lawyer for the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union, says laws were not followed in recruiting foreign doctors.
The union's interest in the matter is to safeguard the interests of this Kenyan doctors. Were this Kenyan doctors not employed and their positions that they could fill themselves, yet these positions are being offered to foreigners, obviously this does not sit well with the union and its members.
The Court of Employment and Labour Relations is expected to issue a ruling next week on the Cuban doctors. The question is, will the government heed its decision? Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This month, the Norwegian Refugee Council released its list of world's most neglected displacement crises, with 4.5 million people internally displaced and 700,000 people have fled to neighboring countries. The Democratic Republic of Congo tops their list. The DRC country director Ulrika Blom spoke to reporter Ricky Shryok about the worsening crisis in the country.
Already in 2016, it was the country with the largest increase of newly displaced in the world. And this situation then in 2017 has resulted in enormous needs, of course, this year in 2018, where 4.5 million are displaced and estimated 13.5 million people are in need. And the humanitarian response program then are aiming at doubling the efforts in 2018.
A lot of your report focuses on the fact that this crisis is neglected, that it doesn't get as much media attention as perhaps the conflict in Syria, et cetera. I mean, I guess there's two questions. Why is that? And why is it important to get media attention?
Why is always difficult? It is a lot of fatigue, I think, with regard to Congo. It's a crisis that has been ongoing for many years, but also it's far away from Europe and different in its character, of course, than the crisis in the Middle East. There are many conflicts it's mainly in Africa where the neglected crises are. Congo is with its high number of displaced in a very severe situation, of course. If we say what is the effect of being neglected, media has an important role of mobilizing resources and interest in a country, of course. And the situation at this point is that the last numbers I saw was that only 17% of the humanitarian response plan is funded. And that means, of course, that more or less 80% of the response cannot be carried out. And that will have a severe consequence. So that is why we call on all these neglected crises, that it is important to get attention so that we also get funding and engagement in these crises.
When you talk about interest and fundraising, is it difficult for people to give funds to something where they don't see a sustainable long-term solution being developed by the government, per se, in DRC?
It is, of course, difficult to year after year give money to a humanitarian crisis. But for us, it is very important to see the people behind and the ones that actually are affected. 4.5 million people are quite many, and even if we are tired, we need to keep going so that these people survive these conflicts.
When we talk about 2018, do you see signs of the displacement growing worse, or is it improving?
We are working in all the areas of displacement at this time, is that there are still enormous needs and conflict ongoing. So definitely we need much more assistance and funds.
The UN and international aid agencies warned the assault on Yemen's main port of Hodeidah by Saudi-backed government forces threatens the lives of hundreds of thousands of people and puts millions more at risk of starvation and disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The attack on the rebel Houthi-held port of Hodeidah is causing alarm among aid agencies, who are warning of serious consequences on the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi tells VOA the port of Hodeidah not only imports crucial humanitarian relief supplies, but is also the main entry point for traded commercial goods.
This is how Yemen survives: fuel, food, medicines, at least these three big areas. And I think that fighting will make it more difficult for that access to happen. So that's very worrying. Military responses aggravating the humanitarian catastrophe of Yemen. This continues to be not the biggest displacement crisis, but the biggest humanitarian crisis of the world. I think that this will make it worse.
Last week, humanitarian coordinator for Yemen, Lise Grande, warned a military attack on the port could cost the lives of 250,000 people. Monday, the United Nations evacuated its international staff from Hodeidah in anticipation of this action. Several days ago, the International Committee of the Red Cross withdrew 71 members of its international staff from Yemen following threats and the killing of one of its employees. ICRC Regional Director Robert Mardini says the push for Hudaydah is likely to exacerbate an already catastrophic situation in Yemen. Since March 2015, when the Saudi-led coalition began bombing the Houthi rebels in support of the government, more than 10,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed. The United Nations estimates 22 million people need humanitarian aid. About 8 million face starvation, and outbreaks of diseases put many people at risk of death. The UN Children's Fund warns at least 300,000 children who live in the Hudaydah area are in imminent danger. In addition, it notes 11 million children throughout this war-torn country are in need of humanitarian aid. It says choking off the lifeline provided by the port of Hudaydah will have devastating consequences for every one of them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And the most widely used anti-malaria drug may fall short for children and pregnant women, according to a new study. Researchers found these patients' bloodstreams contained lower than average concentrations of one of the most active ingredients. Their research may explain why standard treatment sometimes fails to cure these sensitive groups. VOA's Steve Baragona has more.
Malaria cases are down 60% since 2000, thanks to multi-billion dollar global efforts. But the battle is not over, says Frank Kloperga at University College London.
More than 400,000 people are killed every year by malaria. And actually, most of them are small children below 5 years of age in the sub-Saharan regions in Africa.
The best, most widely used treatment is a three-day course of pills combining two drugs, artemether and lumefantrine. But most drug trials have not included children and pregnant women who may absorb or metabolize medicines differently. Kloperga says children have different levels of key enzymes, for example.
Pregnant women also have changes in body composition. You can think about water and fat content. And this also has an impact on how the drug distributes through the body.
Some studies have found children and pregnant women are more likely than others to develop malaria again within weeks of treatment. Writing in the journal PLOS Medicine, Kloperga and colleagues combined data from 31 studies, which included more than 4,000 patients. They looked at blood levels of lumefantrine 7 days after treatment began.
Pregnant women were, for example, 20% lower, and depending on the body weight group in children, it was somewhere between 15 and 25% lower.
He says that raises the risk not only that treatment will fail, but also that resistance will develop. Malaria parasites exposed to lower levels of the drug may survive treatment and produce resistant strains. Kloperga and colleagues developed a model that suggests taking the pills for 5 days would be more effective than the current 3-day schedule. It's an important, well-done study, says Andrea Bosman, malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment coordinator at the World Health Organization. However, he adds,
it is still a modeling study, and we do not generally make recommendations based on modeling studies alone. We require clinical data.
And Bosman says longer treatment carries its own risks.
It has a downfall in terms of adherence to treatment, because the more you ask the people to take, the less becomes the compliance.
Less compliance means more treatment failure and more risk of resistance. Other studies have not concluded that changing treatment is necessary. Kloperga and colleagues are applying for funding to conduct a clinical trial of the 5-day treatment schedule. It'll be several years before results are in. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Washington.
And the Gambian government has opened an investigation into the alleged theft of fertilizer meant for Gambian farmers at its Ministry of Agriculture. This revelation was made at a news conference organized by the president's office on Wednesday. Reporter Pat Nderimbai has more on this.
Over 27,000 bags of fertilizer were reportedly stolen from the government stores in Banjul and sold to a Senegalese businessman. The businessman, who goes with the name Modu Diba, was arrested by Gambian security officials following attempts to load more trucks of fertilizer from the store. Ami Bojan Sisho is the director of press at the president's office.
Also, as part of the issues, his briefing on agriculture, the president has been informed that an old fertilizer stock that has been allegedly sold by the Minister of Agriculture, an investigation has been conducted, and the report was sent to the Ministry of Justice for legal advice. And the president awaits the advice from the ministry.
Gambia's Agriculture Minister, Omar Amadi Jallo, has surfaced in the ongoing probe. Jallo is the leader of the opposition People's Progressive Party. He has served as agriculture minister in the former President Jawara's government. Abubakar Tambedu is Gambia's justice minister.
I can confirm that the report by the investigative panel was forwarded by the Office of the Prosecutor to my ministry and that the matter is under review. We have not yet completed our review, but I can confirm that the matter is with us.
Tambedu told VOA in an interview that he cannot confirm or deny whether Minister Jallo is implicated in the alleged corruption case. But he stressed that his ministry will get to the bottom of this matter.
Well, I can assure you that it doesn't matter who is implicated. If an offense has been committed, we will give our advice and we will advise based on the law and the facts.
Meanwhile, the Ministry of Finance has been engulfed in a single sourcing contractual scandal. The ministry has contracted a foreign private telecommunication company, Singos Quadram, to manage Gambia's international gateway network without a competitive bidding for the contract. The Minister of Communication and Information, Demba Ali Jao, had to protest to the finance minister for allowing the single sourcing. Jao said his ministry was completely sidelined during the contract awarding.
Well, I am certainly aware that Honorable Jao has expressed concern over the manner in which the Ministry of Finance is handling that matter. I have been copied in the correspondence from Honorable Jao to Honorable Sane, and I think those concerns are legitimate based on information available to me.
Tambedu said the president's office has since called for the suspension of the contract until further notice. He says contracts of such nature should be exposed to public bidding.
I know, as a matter of general law, the GPPA Act requires an open bidding process, but there are occasions when it exceptionally provides for single sourcing. Whether or not in this particular instance the conditions for single sourcing were met, I do not know because I'm not privy to all the facts.
Tambedu says the Borough government is committed to fighting corruption. He also says the rule of law will continue to shine in the new Gambia. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandere Mbai reporting.
A new report in Uganda has implicated members of security organs as the main violators of human rights. The report says members of Uganda police lead in torture of suspects and officers who commit such crimes are usually not punished. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
Medi Kagwa, the chairperson of the Uganda Human Rights Commission, says the commission received many complaints over the police brutality last year. He says members of the commission visited prisons and detention facilities to investigate the way police handles suspects. He says the commission registered many cases of murder in the country in 2017 as compared to 2016. The commission registered 202 murder cases in 2017 as compared to 175 in 2016.
We get these figures from the complaints we receive. And for this year, the biggest number of complaints regarding violation was by the police, which was 419, which is 55.7 of the entire complaints. Private individuals were 27.9. Then followed the UPDF with a smaller percentage, 5.8, and then Uganda Prison Service at 3.3.
Livingstone Sewanyana, the executive director of Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, a rights watchdog in Uganda, says he wasn't surprised by the findings.
That has been the trend for quite some time. The police has
always been in the lead, and more so if you take into consideration the torture of suspects at the dreaded Nalufenya. I'm sure you heard about Nalufenya, which was a subject of public outcry.
The notorious Nalufenya detention was closed this year after many suspects, including politicians, mainly from the opposition, said they had suffered inhumane treatment at the facility, forcing the parliament to ask for its closure. The report, which was released late last week, also said there was an increase of violation of rights to properties, especially land. It said overall there was an increase to crimes in the country, especially in urban areas. For example, the report said between January and June 2017, the police received over 700 cases of rape, 191 cases of domestic violence, and a shocking over 20 women murders in the capital Kampala and neighboring towns. Sewanyana says the police does not usually grant suspects quick trials before the courts of law.
They have always argued that the 48 hours are not enough for them to carry out the investigations. But 48-hour rule is all about bringing suspects before the courts of law. So yes, detaining people outside the 48-hour rule has been also another issue of concern.
Kagwa agrees. He says the police need to be well educated on human rights law and be given modern equipment to investigate and detect crimes.
There's more need for more training, need for equipment, because now crime is very sophisticated. So they would need to cope up with the new development in technology to try and advance DNA and all the rest. We also feel that the police should make a close look at who has guns. Because it seems there are so many guns in the hands of people, the police should try to establish who has a gun, what type of gun, why is this person having this gun.
Police spokesman Emiliani Kaima was not available for comment. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Thank you, Mugume Davis Rwakarinji. We should also mention that it has been reported that Uganda's former head of police, General Kale Kaihura, who was recently replaced in a reshuffle, is said to have been arrested by the military. We'll have more for you on this story as it develops. And that's it for this Thursday, June the 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. And join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports.
We will rock you.
Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll look into the controversial topic of term limits for African leaders. Many heads of state disdain the restriction in order to maintain a grip on power. Term limits versus leaders for life on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
It's been a long week. You worked hard. Probably need a break. I can help you with that. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, tune in and relax, energize, connect with great music and great people from across the African continent. This Sunday's 55-minute program features promising young artists on the rise. There's also music news and a feature song of the week from Ghana this time that will keep you current and hip to what's happening on the continent. So So join me this Sunday and the following Saturday at 1505 and 20500 UTC. Music time in Africa. Yeah!
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.